on flashpoints, Bush calls for a Palestinian state, but does he mean it? Israeli colonizers kill a half dozen Palestinians in another attack on Jenin. Also, the former president and COO of the Pacific Stock Exchange arrested blocking the doors in a protest against the war. The Pentagon in the newsroom and legendary singer-songwriter Michael Franti on war, peace, and healing. I'm Dennis Bernstein, all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We welcome back Ali Abunima of the Electronic Intifada and the Arab American Action Network. Ali, last we spoke, we were talking about the new prime minister for Palestine. There was a most extraordinary and bizarre speech, quick speech given by George Bush, talking about a new roadmap for Palestine. What did you make of that?
Well, it was definitely bizarre, Dennis. I mean, one of the things I think it just shows how bankrupt American policy is now is that the first thing they've said about the Middle East in months is to congratulate the Palestinians for appointing one of the most notoriously corrupt men in the Palestinian Authority as prime minister. And I don't think we covered all the territory last time, so just to remind people who the prime minister candidate is, Mahmoud Abbas, in addition to his political views, which are very problematic for the vast majority of Palestinians, this is the man who, soon after the Palestinian Authority was established, began building a $1.5 million villa in Gaza within sight of the most squalid and wretched refugee camps on earth, funded by unknown sources. So the corruption started right up front, and this is the man that the United States is hailing as a great reformer. As for the rest of Bush's statement, it just strikes me as, to the extent that one could comprehend it, really a cynical and meaningless exercise. It imposes no obligation whatsoever on Israel. Bush said that, one day when Israel feels safe and they're making progress towards security, they might be asked to stop the settlements. But no immediate obligations on Israel, impossible demands of the Palestinians as usual, and I think a very cynical attempt to appear to be doing something in an attempt to rally support for the war for Iraq. But I think what it shows more than anything, Dennis, is two things. One, how out of touch with reality this administration is, and how poorly advised the president is. And I think we're witnessing the most incompetent and parochial American diplomacy and policymaking in living memory.
Now, it was out of the blue, wherever that is. It took everybody by surprise. People were expecting him to talk about the failure of the U.S. to force a second resolution, or maybe the planned meeting between Spain, Great Britain, and the U.S. in Portugal. None of that had come up. Here he was, a quick speech, Colin Powell next to him. Does this mean that there's been just tremendous pressure from the Arab world saying you can't go forward with this if at least you don't say something about Palestine and the situation?
You know, I can't believe that it indicates that, Dennis, for the simple reason that nobody in the Arab world can seriously believe that this would, A, either produce real progress, B, provide anyone with political cover to support a war in Iraq. It's so transparently ridiculous. I mean, Bush referred to the confirmation of a new Palestinian prime minister. Well, we already talked about that in the last show, and just now I told you what the caliber of this man is. It offers absolutely nothing to the Palestinian people. What you have is one discredited and ridiculous leader, Yasser Arafat, appointing another corrupt and discredited leader to lead nothing. To lead what? There's no Palestinian authority, there's no state. And on the Israeli side, Bush said, you know, there's a new government there. Well, this is a government which is made up of parties that openly run on a platform of ethnic cleansing. I mean, there exists no ingredients whatsoever for any roadmap except one that leads us all straight to hell. So I think it's just a very cynical exercise. I think, you know, I'm getting to the point where I can't believe people who are so cynical could be this stupid. So I'm beginning to think they're just incredibly naive and really out of touch with reality. And it's hard to put any other explanation on why Bush would have made this statement or who he thought would buy it. I can't see any constituency buying this.
Well, and finally, of course, it comes on another bloody day. Some 12 Palestinians were killed on the West Bank. In fact, the Israelis also killed two of their own guards in an attack.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, look at that. Bush didn't say anything about a night in which Israeli death squads killed 12 people in Jenin and near Nablus, and after a week in which Israel killed 23 Palestinians, the vast majority of them unarmed civilians and four of them children. And he didn't have a word to say about that. And of course, people on the ground, people in Palestine and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon who are watching and listening are aware of all these things. Their news, their concerns are dominated by what's going on in Palestine. And the fact that the media do such a good job of hiding it from us here doesn't mean that people there aren't fully aware of the hypocrisy and the cynicism of these sorts of statements.
All right, Ali Abunima, Arab American Action Network, electronicintifada.net. People should check that out. And we thank you for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're listening to Flashpoints. We continue our coverage of occupied Palestine. As we stated, at least 12 people were killed in the last 24 hours by Israeli colonizers. Among the regular targets of Israeli soldiers are ambulances and ambulance workers. We now go to Jenin in the occupied West Bank, where at least a half dozen Palestinians were killed during an invasion earlier today. We're joined by Tobias, a member of the International Solidarity Movement based in Jenin. Tobias, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.
All right, why don't you bring us up to date? It's been a pretty bloody time there in Jenin. Tell us what's been going on.
The last 24 hours has been pretty horrible here. There has been 10 deaths in the area, and it started out yesterday evening in a village called Tamun, where special forces made an operation, killing five and injuring one person. And this injury was prevented from going to the hospital with the ambulances for over 16 hours. And the operations continued today, when at 7 a.m. there was a big explosion in the refugee camp in Jenin. And a few minutes later, the Palestine Red Crescent Society got the phone call that there was injured people. And they tried to approach the scene. After a 35 minutes delay, they could bring in one dead. A few minutes after that, they got another phone call about four dead people in a house that had been killed.
Was the house attacked? Was it bombed? Are they attacking with tanks and Apache helicopters?
This was a special operation targeted at the nation. There was no fighting. From these people were sleeping in the house when they were assassinated. One person, the first who was brought in dead, he was tried to escape the scene and he was shot down by an Apache helicopter. The others were executed inside the building, where the soldiers blew up the door and fired through the windows on sleeping people inside. And one of the persons inside the building was a long-time volunteer for the Red Crescent Society in Jenin, working with the children camps, some regular work with the small children, 4 to 7 years, weekly.
And what was his name, the ambulance worker who worked with the children now killed? What was the name?
His name is Watik Bashir. He was 17 years old and he's been a volunteer for over 2 years. And I met very many children today crying, and they all say that they love him and he was a very, very easygoing, very appreciated person among all the children in the city and in the camp that I've talked to today.
So this is a 17-year-old volunteer with the Red Crescent who has been working with kids in a camp. And he was executed just a little bit ago.
He was executed while sleeping inside a building by Israeli special forces. And in addition to that, I can tell you that less than 10 days ago, another Red Crescent volunteer, also 17 years old, called Hicham Amor, was also killed as an innocent bystander in another failed assassination attempt inside the Jenin city. He was shot from behind with one dum-dum bullet in the heart, 100 meters from a scene where the Israelis tried to do an operation catching a wanted person.
It seems that being an ambulance driver or an ambulance worker for the Red Crescent is perhaps one of the most dangerous professions in the world these days.
Yeah, I can totally agree on that. And on the 16th of March last year, the head of the Red Crescent Society here in Jenin, Dr. Khalil Suleiman, was shot dead in his ambulance. They fired a grenade upon the ambulance when he was on his way to evacuate injured people in the camp here. And three other in the staff were severely burnt in this incident.
Tobias, what is the general mood of the people inside of the camp in Jenin? Are people angry, furious? Is the resistance movement growing in response to these continued attacks?
I can tell you about the feeling today, and the feeling today is sadness. I've seen many people crying all over Jenin, and there is a very, very sustained mood all over the city and the camp.
Is there enough food for people at this point? Is there enough medicine if they manage to get to the hospital? What are the circumstances what is life like in a daily basis for people?
What I can tell you about the situation right now, actually the curfews inside the city have been lifted for at least over a month, but still the city is under a heavy closure, which means that all the movement from the villages outside into the city is extremely restricted, even for persons that need medical attention and so on. And also this is a very big problem for students, of course, who are many days prevented from at all going to their schools, and also the teachers face these problems.
I understand there's a lot of suffering among young people, among the kids. Kids are troubled, emotionally troubled. We're hearing a lot about bedwetting, even some malnutrition. What can you say about the effect on children?
The effect on children is horrible to see. The small children, many of them are more or less catatonic from the incidents or the incursion in April last year. There are very many psychological effects concerning what happened then. Many small boys in the ages of 4 to 6, they have stopped talking and they're totally impossible to get in contact with. And also there is, of course, no professional instances here in Jenin that can attend to matters like this under the circumstances.
Finally, the President of the United States, the selected President of the United States, made a speech today about his hopes for peace and a Palestinian state with a new Prime Minister. Were people in Jenin aware of this in the West Bank about what the President said? Was there any hope there?
Actually, I haven't had any opportunity to discuss this with people today. I haven't myself heard this speech, and as I said, the general feeling here in Jenin is sadness. Everybody is thinking about their dead and their sons. There has been no space for discussions like this today.
All right. Tobias, a member of the International Solidarity Movement, speaking to us from Jenin, once again under siege, 17-year-old Red Crescent worker shot dead in his bed. Many kids upset about it. We thank you for the courage to be there and for speaking with us on Flashpoints, Tobias. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We continue our discussion about the ongoing ethnic cleansing, ethnic purge, attack, colonization of Palestine. I don't know what to call it, slaughter, daily war crime operation. Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance is in studio with me. She's going to be at the protest tomorrow, where I imagine many, many of you will be, because the war maniacs in Washington are definitely ready to go. Barbara, what's your response, first of all, to what you just heard from Tobias? You know, a bunch of kids crying, a 17-year-old counselor gone.
It makes me very sad, Dennis. I've actually been pretty sad over the last couple of days, last couple of centuries, actually, because one of the young boys from the Dahesa refugee camp who's living with me now, Ahmed, his brother was arrested 2 days ago. The Israelis went into his home, his mother's home, in the Dahesa refugee camp and took his brother away. He's 22 years old, not very political, and he has now ended up in Muscovia prison. Inside Israel, and he has been not charged, but they're holding him on a 6 months administrative detention. And this is what the Israelis have done for the last 25, 30 years, is they'll arrest Palestinians. They don't charge them. They don't, and they just hold them on administrative detention. They can hold them up to 6 months, and it's renewable. So what happens is that many young people spend years in prison never being charged, so they can't defend themselves, you know, they can do nothing. And every 6 months, the Israeli courts can just say, okay, we're giving you another 6 month administrative detention. So I know the sadness. I see it in Ahmed's eyes, and he's on the computer, he's on the internet all day and night when he's not in school, you know, trying to get information about his brother. And you know, I'm very close to all of this because all three of the kids who are here and living with me are they're trying to have a great time going to San Francisco State. They're trying to enjoy themselves here. But every day, every minute of every day and all through the night, they're just trying to find out what's happening to their families and their friends in Palestine.
Well, and I want to talk about this in the context of the impending war. Clearly, there's a great danger that when the U.S., when the U.S. starts dropping endless bombs and attacks the people of Iraq, Ariel Sharon is going to be ready to strike. The possibility of a horrific action is simply predictable.
Well, that's, of course, the major concern of the Palestinians is that, as you said, that once they go into Iraq, start the bombing, that it really, Ariel Sharon has been given the go-ahead by the United States government to do whatever he needs to do in the name of Israeli security. And, you know, we hear about, you know, the need for Israeli security and security for the people in Israel, and I've heard it for many years. And I firmly believe and know that I'm correct, that the only real security for Israel, for the children in Israel, is justice for the Palestinians and to really deal justly with them.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. There are going to be protests all over the country, in the Bay Area. We'll be in San Francisco. It will start at Civic Center, march to Jefferson Square Park. Pacifica will be there. KPFA will be there.
11 o'clock in the morning. It's going to start at Civic Center. And it looks like it may be very rainy, very cold, very windy. So we should all just put on our slickers, put on our rain gear, bring our umbrellas, and or just get wet. Because whatever we experience tomorrow as a result of the very bad weather is nothing compared to what the Iraqi people will be experiencing over the next week or so. So, you know, we get wet. What the hell?
Or what they've been experiencing for the
12 years. You know, you would think it was just happening next week from the way people talk. But in reality, let's not forget that a million children are dead because of the UN-US sanctions against the people. And that, I don't know. I think that I'm hoping that hundreds of thousands of us will be back in the street. I think the most important thing we can show is a solid wall of opposition to the possibility of a new war on the people of Iraq. I understand people are going to Sacramento to confront or to demonstrate for the Democrats. There's a state Democratic convention. I think that's fine, but I think that we should all be in San Francisco. I'm thinking about all of our Democratic state representatives here and the people that will be there who are running for president. All of them have supported the sanctions against the children of Iraq. Every single one of them is responsible for the deaths of the children. And every single one of them in Congress congratulated Ariel Sharon on winning this election. Every single one of them, I believe, voted, and I could be wrong, please correct me if I'm wrong, I know this listening audience will, but I think almost every single one of them voted for the budget to send more aid to Israel to do what they are doing to the Palestinians, and I say shame on every single one of them.
Well, the technique is going to be shock and awe, you know, shock and awe, obviously just terminate them. I mean, I saw a newscast the other day, and the first one, part of the cast, was dropping the 23,000-pound bomb, smash, bam, boom. And then the next segment was, they won't disarm these Iraqis. Wonder why.
Well, you know, Dennis, I remember the day George Azar and I arrived back into Baghdad a month after the Gulf War, and what we witnessed ourselves, and that was 12 years ago, the streets torn up, the buildings, the apartment buildings down, the people dead. Over 200,000 civilians died during that war.
Well, I can tell you,
and this will be worse.
This will be worse. And when I think about shock and awe, I also think about the kids in Palestine that have stopped talking. They're in shock and they're in awe. And we hear more and more of that shock and awe. Again, it's this weekend, 11 o'clock. It's
Civic Center.
Civic Center. March to Jefferson Square Park. You can see one former congresswoman who I think is going to be very interesting, Cynthia McKinney, Danny Glover, Martin Sheehan, Barbara Lubin will be there, many, many other people, and hopefully you will be there too, because this is the time.
This is the last
the
time.
The war is at our doorstep. It is coming, folks. Barbara, thank you very much
for
all the great work. Coming up next, we're going to hear about a CEO, a former CEO, and the head of the San Francisco Stock Exchange was busted there protesting war. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Hundreds of people this morning blocked the entrances of the Pacific Stock Exchange in San Francisco to protest the planned attack on Iraq. Many were arrested. Among those cuffed and taken away was an unlikely suspect, Lieutenant Colonel retired Warren Langley, the former president and chief operating officer of the Pacific Stock Exchange. He joins us now fresh from jail. Lieutenant Colonel, welcome to Flashpoint.
Thanks very much.
Usually, you used to go to the Pacific Stock Exchange and enter in a different manner.
This was sort of a different experience there, sort of stopping at the door and then not letting anybody else come in behind me.
An unusual homecoming.
It was very unusual, but it seemed to be important to do, and I really feel good about participating. I have to tell you, I was a little nervous. I've never been arrested before, and so stepping across that line wasn't something that was easy.
Well, let's talk about that. You did go down there and were arrested with more than 100 people. Why did you decide it was time for you, for the first time, a former lieutenant colonel, to commit civil disobedience?
Because people around the world were making their voices heard in their countries, and I didn't think that Mr. Bush and his group of friends were hearing us. And people have been out protesting, people have been marching. I joined my first march in January, but he wasn't hearing, and it seemed to me that we needed to turn the volume up. And this was the way that seemed most appropriate to me.
Well, a former officer and also an officer of the stock exchange, it is significant that you take this action. Aren't you supportive of the military and their goals in Iraq?
I'm very supportive of the military. The military, when I was in it for 15 years, when I know people in it today, do a good job, and I'm very supportive of it. They're being asked to carry out some political goals that I don't agree with, and I think it's important that we distinguish between the two things. I've thought long and hard about how do I deal with the fact that if this war starts and I want to continue to send a message, I need to be sure to send that message as opposing the political decisions and the policy-making decisions, not the individuals who are over-risking their lives on behalf of the citizens of this country.
These days, many people who question the policies of the Bush administration are called, among other things, unpatriotic, as some have suggested, to be terrorists. Do you consider yourself a patriot?
I consider myself very patriotic. I'm just so thankful for all the good things that have happened to me because I was lucky enough to be born in this country. And I think it's patriotic to be a democratic, and I think it's to have your voice heard is a very democratic thing. Particularly important when some, for some reason, our elected officials are being silent. For whatever political reason, they are afraid to speak out, and we've got to make them feel courageous, just like individuals who got arrested today felt courageous.
Tell us what was going through your mind down there before you were arrested. Sort of describe the scene, who was around you, and what was going through your mind.
Well, I'll start back even a little further. I went to a meeting last night, which was sort of training and planning. It's like, what are we going to do tomorrow, and what am I supposed to do, and how do I behave? And fortunately, there were people there that were very articulate about how it should be done, very articulate about this is a nonviolent, non-confrontational message that we're trying to get out, that the fact that if any of us step across that line into violence and destruction, we'll detract from the message. And I felt comforted that I had joined a group of people that had the same values that I did and that were smart about how to do it. So then this morning I showed up down there and we met as a group on the stairs of the stock exchange, and several people spoke from their various perspectives about why they were there and what they wanted to accomplish in terms of stopping the war. Particularly poignant was a woman who'd just recently been in Iraq and had some really large pictures of individual human faces in Iraq, people who will be certainly in danger if we launch this invasion. And then it was time to do something. So we joined hands, walked around the corner from the steps of the stock exchange to the entrance, and blocked the entrance. And then a group of people also sat down in the intersection. And I was nervous but excited. I was looking to people who had more knowledge than I to set the tone. People would come over to me because I did have a suit and tie on. Since I represent the establishment, I thought I should look like who I represent. But I felt comfortable with who I was with and comfortable in what I was doing. We then sat down. The police was there. They came around several times, warning us that we were blocking, warning us that we were subject to arrest. You know, and there were times there where you could get up and leave. And some people who were choosing not to go that far today did. But a large number of people said, I'm willing to go that far. I was one of them. And then they arrested me.
How did it feel to have those cuffs put on your hands?
It just was the culmination of the statement. So it felt uncomfortable, but not bad.
Well, let me ask you, as the former president and the chief operating officer of the Pacific Stock Exchange, I'm sure there were people there who were trying to get in, who were trying to go to work, who were perhaps very angry that there are these protesters here who are blocking their way to work. And some of these people may have even worked under you. Was there any dialogue? What do you think about their feelings?
Well, I have to say that I wasn't confronted by anyone to do that. I think any who did had to get across the point that this is an inconvenience for them. We apologize for the inconvenience, but this message is so important that disrupting business as usual had to be a part of it. And hopefully people like that, when they step back and understand it, even if they don't agree with what's being said, will agree with the right for it to be said and will understand that the inconveniences that it caused were a small price to pay.
Are you concerned that you're jeopardizing your own career?
Well, I'm at a point in my life. I was 60 when I went to my first march on the 18th of January. So I'm at a point in my life, I'm fairly comfortable with who I am, and I hope all the people who are my friends are still my friends, and those who have decided because of the course I've taken that they don't want to be my friends anymore, I'll sadly lose that friendship, but it's probably not a friendship that was based on the right values.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We've been speaking with Lieutenant Colonel retired Warren Langley. He's the former president and chief operating officer of the Pacific Stock Exchange. and he, along with more than 100 others, were arrested, blocking the entrance in protest of the planned war against Iraq. I want to thank you very much for being with us on Flashpoint.
Well, thank you for getting the message out.
Oh, my. Oh, my God. My mother got a suicide scene. Oh, my. Oh, my God. My mother got a suicide scene. Oh, my. Oh, my God. My mother got a suicide scene. Oh, my. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Slam, bam. I come on the scene, but like gasoline. You can tell I'm in the time. Like money in the bank. Smell appealing, but I'm toxic. Send you reeling without an inkling. Keep it thinking, cause you gave cash to the feds at your school district for death. You up in the head, but still they saying nothing's wrong. Selling fire water by outlawing the bomb. Still believing the system is working. Why half of my people are still out of working. Anonymous notes left in the pockets and coats of judges and jurors from Frisco to Jersey. Threats and protests, politicians, mob debts. Trumped up charges and phony arrests. Saved a lethal injection the night before the election. Cause he got donation from the prison guards union. Oh my God. And my mother got a suicide scene. Oh my God. And my mother got a suicide.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Noted singer, songwriter, hip-hopster, and visionary musician Michael Franti has got a special event planned for you in the Bay Area this weekend. Michael will be performing with Spearhead at an event called Spring Cleansing, a celebration of the healing arts through music on Friday, March 14th, Saturday, March 15th. And Michael is in the studio now to talk about that, and we're going to see if we can get him to talk a little bit about his work. I'm very curious. First of all, let me say thank you, and thank you for the necessary music in this time of frightening time of potential mass destruction. Mm-hmm. So it makes a big difference, and I know people listening to this show feel that very strongly. I want to ask you, Michael, I'm very curious just about the work. Which came first, the song, the poem, the rhythm, or maybe sort of Three Eyes at Birth?
Mm-hmm. Well, whenever I write songs, it's never the same process twice. So some songs I come up with the lyric first, some songs it's just the emotion that I have for a long time, and I'm trying to find a way to express it, and I go through many revisions. Sometimes I hear some music or create some music that inspires me, and sometimes it's just a beat, and I start freestyle rhyming over the beat and come up with it. But to me, creative energy all comes from one source, which is that creative spirit. It's the same creative energy that creates a flower, the same creative energy that inspires somebody to put a handle on a door, or to paint a painting, or to make a child. So that's where it all comes from, the one great spirit of creativity.
Let me ask you, how do you see the world now? What do you see as what's gone wrong? Something has gone wrong here. How do you see that?
You know, what we're seeing today in all the voices around the world of people speaking out, because really when I start to do a little math and I think, wait a minute, there's 6 billion of us on the planet and there's like a few hundred leaders who are leading us into down this place of destruction, it doesn't seem to add up. But really what it is, in my perspective, is that the human interests, the natural interests and the spiritual interests of the world have had to take a backseat to the corporate interests, the military interests, and the materialistic interests of the world. And now we're seeing people who are saying, wait a minute, that's not the way we want the world to go. And that's what you see in these mass protests. That's what you see at the WTO, at the Democratic Republican Convention. That's what you see in people speaking out against genetically modified foods and in support of protection of our natural world.
Out of my world and childhood, I remember a story of Bob Dylan throwing Phil Oakes out of his limousine, and Bob Dylan telling Phil Oakes, you're not a musician, you're a journalist with a guitar. I'm wondering where politics comes into the music for you and how that works.
You know, politics is pervasive, you know, throughout society. Politics and globalization has affected the way music is made today, you know, in the same way that it's affected family farms who then became agribusinesses, it's the same thing with music, you know. So, and today, you know, you have a record label like Island Records, who at one point had Bob Marley and U2 in their very early political days. And then they got bought by PolyGram, who gets merges with Def Jam, who gets bought by Universal and Interscope, and then finally the Vivendi Corporation buys up all of that. And so when you have the president of Vivendi resigning, it's not on the music report, it's on the nightly stock report. So they're not looking for the next John Lennon, Bob Dylan, or even Mr. Oaks. You know, they're looking for the next NSYNC, the next Britney Spears, the next thing that is going to satisfy the shareholders at the end of the quarter. And so it affects the message in the music, just like the way that same process affects the news on the networks, you know. And so what we try to do, who are, you know, in the community radio and community music, which is what I see as what I do, we try to hold on to that voice, and we try to not only just make political songs or songs about political events and journalistic songs, but we try to make songs that are and music that is inspiring, that's uplifting, that helps us when we've watched CNN the night before, helps us get up in the morning and have the energy to clean our toilet, take our kids to school, to continue working in this world that seems so frustrating. And to that end, that's why we're doing this event, the Spring Cleansing, because a lot of times we feel so oppressed by all these things that are happening to us. And sometimes even when I'm listening to your show, man, I'm like, man, this everything is going crazy out there, you know, but I listen to it every day, you know. What I learned a couple years ago when I was with Asada Shakur in Cuba, she said, you know, to be a great revolutionary, you have to be there for the revolution. That means you got to take care of your body. You got to take care of your mind. You got to take care of your spirit. You have to take care of your family and your relationships with the people that you love so that you can be there when called upon. And so that's why we're doing this Spring Cleansing. So people on Saturday afternoon starting at about 2:30 or 3 o'clock after the march can come down, learn how to practice yoga, learn how to give and receive massage, learn how to turn your car into a veggie fuel car, learn how to work with flowers. A whole range of healing arts are going to be there.
And let me again remind people, for those of you in the Bay Area, we're talking about a very special event happening this Friday and Saturday. Of course, Michael Franti and Spearhead will be there. But it's more than a concert. Of course, a concert is a great celebration, but here we're going to get into touch.
Mm-hmm.
And touch is sort of the humanizer, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You tend not to wear shoes. Is that because you feel it keeps you closer to the earth?
That's one of the reasons. I started going barefoot about 3 years ago. And I started doing it because I traveled to countries where a lot of people don't wear shoes because they can't afford shoes. And so I would take off my shoes and try to walk around. I felt so tenderfooted that I had to put them back on. And so when I came back from a trip one time, I said, I'm going to go 3 days of a fast without shoes. Just experience that. And after 3 days, I just continued not to wear them. And I've learned a lot from it. Like you said, I feel a greater connection to the earth. I've found that things that hurt my feet, you know, I might get a cut, a little glass in there, something, like pick it out, and my feet heal themselves, you know, more quickly when I don't wear shoes than if I put a shoe on it, you know, or a sock on it. Also, you know, the Creator put all these nerve endings at the bottom of our feet that correspond to the rest of our body. Why didn't he or she put them on the top of our head where they would never be touched or never be injured, possibly? And,
so this is sort of one way that the earth actually can give you back a massage as you move through the day.
It's true.
The event is happening this weekend, Friday and Saturday, for those of you in the Bay Area, at the Avalon Ballroom. That's at 1268 Sutter Street at Van Ness in San Francisco. The concert will start at 7 p.m. The cost, is that for the music and
it's for the music and for everything, and yeah, participating in that.
So they can come early in the afternoon,
yeah.
Practice massage,
yoga, and all
yoga, you know,
spa,
vegetable
yeah.
fuel, whatever
yeah.
it is, and then they can hear incredible music.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, just one concert, my Michael Franti, keeps me going. You know, sometimes you just need to hear something and it's not being said, but
mm-hmm.
You say it in your music and it really has meant a lot to a lot of people. I took your new acoustic CD down with me. I guess it's called The Songs from the Front Porch. I was broadcasting from Houston. Mm-hmm. I played it a couple of times, and I put it down, and it disappeared. Apparently, you're very popular down there as well. So, again, coming back to what we face now mm-hmm. and what's going on between all of us, how do you prepare for this, and what do you tell your friends?
Well, this is why I've become so interested in yoga and all the healing arts, because when I practice yoga, it helps me to develop compassion for myself, helps me to get that critical voice of self-criticism away from me for a moment so I can just be who I am and understand deeper who I am, and in turn have compassion for others to a deeper level. And it helps me to understand what is my position as an artist, what is my position, the role that I can play in the world, and the things that I have control of and some things that I don't have control of. And a lot of times we put a lot of energy, or I put a lot of energy into trying to control things that I can't, you know, mm-hmm. and I become frustrated by that and become less of an activator in the things that I can control and the things that I do have power to help to heal. So my practice of yoga and meditation has really helped me with that, and I want to share that with other people, and that's why we're doing this event. And I remember as a kid, and today I talk about it, you know, like, oh, I remember the first time I got drunk was at this concert, the first time I took acid was at this concert, and I'd really love it for some kid to come up to me 20 years and say, the first time I meditated was at your show. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Well, again, Michael,
it's all ages, too, so bring your kids.
And, well, and so it's a family affair,
It's always a family affair. Kids yoga, and part of the proceeds from the show are going towards our annual 911 concert in September, so it's a fundraiser for raising money for that too.
Great. Again, for those of you in the Bay Area, you can check this out, Avalon Ballroom, 1268 Sutter Street at Van Ness in San Francisco. You can get there, go to the rally, get there 2-3 o'clock, and touch each other. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you, Dennis. Shine on.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another next level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth has never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street morning, afternoon edition. Commandeering airways from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that could never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that could never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn our attention to the corporate control of the media and how the people are hearing less and less because corporations control more and more of the media. That is, fewer corporations, more control. Joining us to talk about this is Peter Phillips. He is the director of Project Censored and a professor of sociology at the Sonoma State University in Northern California. Peter, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me on, Dennis. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, let's talk about this media concentration. Ben Bagdikian set the standard. He went initially writing about 50 corporations. We're down to about 10 that control just about everything. Where are we now?
Well, when Ben, this is almost over a generation ago, was saying 50 media corporations dominate the U.S. news and information systems, we're down to 10. And more importantly, we're down to these 24-hour news programs. The big three in the country are literally the dominant news source for most people in the United States. This is concerning. It's very concerning as to how it fits with Homeland Security, how it helps people make decisions in terms of democratic decisions within a society, and really what we're being told and what's coming out in terms of discussions at dinner tables all over the country. I mean, AOL Time Warner, the largest media system in the world, has 64 magazines, movies, books, 40 record labels, CNN. This is huge. You know, the other groups now are completely interactive with government and corporations in terms of finding sources. And they're very cooperative. Robert Vista had just recently written how there's a row of script writers in Atlanta now who can insist on changes or balances in a reporter's dispatch, so that when the embedded reporters are with the troops in Iraq and going along as the war evolves, their copy is sent to Atlanta to be authorized and perhaps even rewritten to make sure that it fits the parameters of kind of what's acceptable in terms of news for the American public.
And of course, when they're in bed with the troops, of course you could put it that way, they don't have their own mobility, they don't have their own vehicles, they go where they're told.
Even then, reporters still believe in the First Amendment, they believe in the public's right to know in the Constitution. But what's more important from a sociological perspective is how media is structuring itself, how that control is becoming more concentrated. So simply editing a reporter's reports from the field in Atlanta is one piece of that. Ina Howard did a report that we published in Project Censored Book this year in 2003 about how literally 75% of all the experts on news shows are white males, Republican, and that is a continuing problem. So, and it ranges, you know, 75% is kind of a low. It can range up to 85% after the war. So why? The question becomes, why is corporate media kind of so compliant with what the Pentagon wants, with what the State Department wants, with what corporate America wants? I mean, what's the relationship here? And that becomes more obvious when we look at it structurally. Corporate media today is dependent upon news. If you're running a 24-hour news program, you're dependent upon sources for news. You've downsized your newsroom. You no longer have investigative reporters in any capacity. What you really have is news collectors. And these news collectors have these relationships with news suppliers in big corporations and in government. So this is this relationship. So you become dependent upon sources within big bureaucracies, both public and private, for the kinds of news that keep your program going. So it is a symbiotic relationship between government, business, and media. It's all part of the globalization process. It's all part of the top-down news and information that really is occurring in the world as part of keeping a free capital flow. But what's kind of important today is when you look at the Homeland Security Act and how it was passed, and the Patriot Act too. Homeland Security Act, particularly in Title II, Section 201D5, tells the directorate to develop a comprehensive national plan for securing the key resources and critical infrastructure of the United States, including power production, generation, distribution systems, and information technology and telecommunications and all satellites. So the stepping in is the government with a plan, and you've got 10 media corporations who are already cooperating with government, so it becomes a relatively easy thing to talk about really controlling information at government level. So you declare an emergency, or the media is literally totally cooperative. Now, to amplify that, the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee, which is the ones that are really looking at how the Internet's going to work, because the Internet, we can still, it's free flow, you can get reports from all over the world. Now they're really talking about gatekeepers, building in controllers and gatekeepers within this Internet system to be able to block it. Now they're doing this so that terrorists can't attack big corporations and they can't attack the Internet system, so it's going to keep free flow. But what it really does is gives the government the capacity to block the flow at any point within how the whole thing is structured. So the news and information systems that are going through independent media could be blocked by the big corporations and by government. And then, so you're creating an infrastructure that really talks about total information control. This is kind of the opposite of this whole total information awareness package, whereby, you know, your library card can be checked and any books you check out go to the FBI, or your phone calls
your
can
video,
be monitored.
Video.
We all know about that. But the infrastructure that's really being developed in the context of Homeland Security and media concentration really is total information control, which of course leads to kind of total population control with the dominant message that says kind of shut up and go shopping.
And it's interesting because we used to worry about the media being infiltrated by, say, a CIA agent or an editor being in a newsroom. Now there's this kind of new structural connection between media, between CNN and the Pentagon. You don't really need to have a CIA agent in the newsroom because the whole structure is controlled at the government level.
It really becomes increasingly more top-down. It really becomes a interrelationship. And it's not just Dan Rather admitting to Greg Palast that he didn't ask all the important questions after 9/11 out of feelings of patriotism for the country. It really becomes how you organize media and how that media is interbedded within seeking sources of news. So it becomes, you know, in some country, whether it was in historically in Russia, it was the TASS news service, you know, everything came out of the Communist Party, or in other countries there's kind of total control of news and information. We're building the infrastructure for that. We've always prided ourselves in freedom of the press, but the infrastructure that we're building within the United States today is really a total undermining of the idea of freedom of information and free flow between citizen to citizen.
Have you seen a change? Are there more stories? Are there more journalists who can't get their work out? Are you hearing more stories of people being shut down?
Well, certainly we know that journalists are self-censoring, and they've admitted that. The Pew polls 2 years ago, one-third of the journalists admitted that they self-censor or see it happen on a regular
basis. And that means they know...
They know a story, and they don't fully develop it. Or maybe they don't even try to develop it, because they know it won't fit well in terms of their career mobility within the media system that they're working for. In terms of total numbers of stories, that's kind of hard to measure. But Project Censored has no problem identifying several hundred stories each year that don't make it in the corporate media that are significant. And all we do is pick, like, the top 25 and every year come out with a list that says these are important, the corporate media hasn't covered them. But it's much bigger than that. It goes much deeper. There's a grassroots reaction to this. There's grassroots media emerging worldwide that is really responding to this kind of gap of news and information the corporate media leaves us with, so that networks like Pacifica and indie media and independent news sources all over the world are emerging and trying to fill this in. But if we block the gateways in terms of distribution of that kind of information and the laws, we could be running into some very serious consequences there.
Peter, how do you get your information? How do you recommend people get their information and decide essentially what they can believe or think is in some way true or reliable?
It's really hard. In terms of corporate media, literally, it pretty much all looks the same. So I would say if you can get Free Speech TV, if you can read the Christian Science Monitor, if you can read The Nation, those are all good, you know, Mother Jones. There's a variety of good independent publications that are out there. But we really need stuff that's on people's breakfast tables, and that was the goal of the North Bay Progressive newspaper.
That you've helped develop now.
It's a number of activists in Sonoma County, North Bay Progressive. You can see it online at www.northbayprogressive.org. We have 1,300 subscribers now, and it's all the news that didn't fit in the corporate media. That's our goal. And we're seeing that happen worldwide. When I was in Cairo, I met these young people who are doing a website called Islam Today, which is, you know, happening, and this sort of phenomenon is happening worldwide, and we're getting grassroots news from people who were there, who saw it happen, and are able to tell the story. The better we can at the micro level, get it on the radio, get it on cable access news shows, even if it's a mimeographed newsletter of stuff you found on the internet, and you give it 20 people, you're a journalist. And that's what's happening. And there must be 30 people that do a daily screening of the internet, and will send little stories they think are important, and increasingly that's happening. So that's real important, and then keeping the communication channels open and alive.
So for people in the Bay Area, you've got a couple of very important events coming up, events that support Project Censored, that support the work that you're doing. Why don't you tell us what you got coming up?
Well, on March 14th, Friday night, Norman Solomon is speaking at Sonoma State University. It's called Target Iraq: What the News Media Did Not Tell You. It's based on his new book and him visiting Baghdad. That's at 7 p.m. at Sonoma State University in the Cooperage facility there on campus. And this is going to be a great event. I mean, this is really the stories that we're not being told. It's what the corporate media isn't telling us about Iraq. And then coming up at the end of the month, on Saturday, March 29th, at the Marin Center Veterans Memorial Auditorium, Congressman Dennis Kucinich is coming to California, literally for the first time since declaring himself for president. And this is a full educational process in terms of Dennis giving a speech, telling us his positions. Tickets are available at the Marin Center box office or at Ticketmaster's. And so this is Congressman Dennis Kucinich coming in from Ohio to really talk about his plans for peace and his presidential bid.
Is there one phone number if people just want to get a phone number so they can follow up on this?
There's 415-499-6800 is about the tickets. And this is Saturday, March 29th, 8 p.m. in Marin.
All right, Peter Phillips, Project Censored. Great group, great work. Thanks for being with us again on Flashpoint.
Thanks very much, Dennis.
And that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein, with associate producer Leslie Kane and contributing producer Robert Knight. Our technical directors are Mary Bishop and Ranjita Geisler. We had production assistance from Stephanie Hendricks and from Eric Park. For a taped copy of this broadcast, call 510-848-6767, extension 625. An archive of our recent shows can be heard on the web at www.flashpoints.net. Many thanks to John Lionheart, our web maestro, and thank you for listening.